Hello, I'm Jack.
And I'm Martin.
And we are The Washboard Resonators. Welcome to our podcast, The Washboard Resonators Present. Conversations from behind the red curtain on vintage music and stories from the entertainment industry. Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Washboard Resonators Present. And today, who have we got, Martin?
Well, we've got somebody, a chap called Dick Appleton, who lives in the east of England, we shall say. And he's somebody I met from buying some guitars. He's a fascinating guy. He's made a life in music. He's supported a family in music. He's ended up with, I don't want to say the number, but a ridiculous selection of fine guitars. And he's an interesting guy. You know, I love chatting to him. And he's got so many great tales going back to the 60s and the British beat and blues boom and sort of seeing bands and then playing folk clubs all the way through. And he's, you know, known quite a lot of the great players in the folk world. So, yeah, I really like and respect this guy. And he's told me loads of stories all over the place. And I can't join them together in my head. So let's just bring Dick Appleton on and let's try and piece together his life and tell his story.
Here we go.
So here we are with Dick Appleton. The way we start these kind of things, Dick, is we just love to talk about what your life in music is and get a feel of things. So where we start is we say, where and when were you born?
All right. Yeah, I was born in 1950 in Cleethorpes, which is just down the road.
What's your first sort of major memory of music and when did you feel like it became something that was central in your life?
It was always there.
So is it a family thing or is it kind of like,
I never, I never knew my father. My mother did, apparently. but apparently he played the mandolin.
Ah, okay. So there's some of that going on.
And my mother played the piano.
Right.
She played the grand piano in a marching band. She had a terrible life.
Need some big wheels.
She played the piano for the Methodist Church and she would sing for the Methodist Church and all that sort of business. And we had a piano in the front room.
Okay.
And music was just always there. We'd have family get-togethers and people would sing at the piano and that sort of business. And it was always just there and listening to the radio.
Yeah, yeah. Did you find yourself going to church and joining in with all that?
No, I mean, yeah, I went. It was the normal thing. You, as a kid, you went to Sunday school and that, and sang hymns and that, which were okay.
And do you feel like that's a good kind of training ground? Because I'm reading a lot of like blues history at the moment, and everybody that I love, like whether it was Blind Boy Fuller or Robert Johnson, they all went to church on a Sunday. They all seemed to learn to sing, singing in choirs and stuff. Do you feel like it was a good sort of place to learn?
Well, yeah, I'd always sung at school in school choirs and things. And there's just it's like playing football, honest, in that it's a team thing. I've been doing some research because in 1961, I was in the school choir and we got headhunted by the Grimsby Junior Philharmonic Choir.
Right.
And she ran that and she picked the best ones out of the school choir. And I was one of those, believe it or not.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And I sang in the Grimsby Junior Philharmonic Choir. And we went to the Llangollen, to the East Deptford.
You speak Jack's language now.
Sorry?
Are you speaking Jack's language now? He's a very proud Welshman.
Oh, are you really?
Yeah. From South Wales, though. Yeah.
Until you mentioned football, I suppose he would be, yeah. Yeah.
So you're talking 1961, so you win this choir contest.
Yeah.
So by 61, are you playing an instrument?
No.
Not quite yet.
I've been writing songs since I was seven.
Writing songs, but without an instrument. So you didn't fancy playing piano, even though your mum did?
No, me auntie, I had an auntie, a family friend that was an auntie. We had loads of, you know, family friends who were aunties and drunkles and things like that. And she taught the piano and that. And my mum took me to this auntie's one day and my auntie and I sat down at the piano in the front room and she showed me middle C on the piano. And at some point during that, she sort of stood up and walked round. So she was facing me because I was looking out the window. She said, "You're not really bothered about this, are you?" So I said, "No, not really." And that was that. That was me musical training.
That was the piano.
But no, it never. At home, I would sit and pick tunes out. I got loads of aunties, and one of them, my mother couldn't play a note without the music in front of her.
Right.
But her younger sister, my auntie Ivy, would sit down with me at the piano and say, "Right, Richard, what are we going to sing?" And she'd just play anything just by ear. And I would do that. I would pick notes and things out and play and then write tunes, but not know what I was doing.
But this is age 7.
Before then, really. But yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But seven, I can remember standing up at school in the infants class at the age of 7 and wanted to sing a song.
Okay. Yeah. So I mean, this is fascinating. So I mean, already we know that there's just this very formative kind of music that sounds to be seeping in very informally with your family, which will probably make a lot of sense as we go down the line now. So 61, you've won the choir contest. So this is interesting for me because one of the things I find fascinating when I've been to your house is talking about the 60s music scene. So here you are, you're 11 in 61. When you think the Beatles sort of really coming out in 62, 63, you are, I would say, the prime age. You know, when people get into music at 12, 13, 14, at probably one of the most exciting explosions of like music and youth culture the world has ever seen. What happens as we go through those kind of early to mid 60s? Like, is that where the guitar comes? Does something else come?
It was, yeah, it was the Beatles and then the Rolling Stones.
Okay.
I mean,
Have you got a preference?
No.
No, they're both
because
good
they were both, they both did some really good versions of some really good songs.
That's so true.
And they were very different. So you took a bit from everyone, I think. You know, but before the Beatles, there was things that would just sort of appear on the radio, so they didn't actually appear physically. There were these mundane programs, sing something simple and all these sort of things. And I could put the simple in that. And they were so mundane. But all of a sudden you'd hear the Highwaymen singing Tom Dooley.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden from somewhere sneaking in on workers' playtime on a dinner time, you'd hear, apart from all the bad comedians, all the great comedians I'd listened to, you'd hear the odd little bit of Peter, Paul and Mary and the odd sort of folk song, Michael Row the Boat Ashore and things like that. And they were and they just resonated. And then you find there's harmonies in them. And I've always been a great lover of harmony, which singing on your own is quite difficult. But yeah, so it was like, oh, there is something else out there, which then made you look for it, if you like. You had to look for, and then... Having looked for it, you had to have ability to find it, but not only find it, but grab it while it was there. Somebody said to Dylan once, "Where do you get all your ideas from?" And he said, "They're all around you. You just have to pluck them out of the air."
Yeah.
And that was the fact, you know, that you have to, when you do get these, you have to be receptive to it.
Yeah.
And that was the thing with the music. And when the Beatles hit, I've still got Love Me Do. I bought that the day it came out because I'd read about it in a little bit in the Musical Express that this group had come back from Liverpool, from Hamburg, and got a single out called Love Me Do. And I also bought My Bonnie as well, which was the first single that came out on the Polydor label. And I got those because I got a record player when I was 12 for passing me 11 plus.
Oh, good. Congratulations.
I got a bike as well, but you can't play records on a bike.
No, you can't, but it's still...
Well, you know, it makes cornering difficult anyway, yeah.
It's the other side of rock and roll, isn't it? I'm sure, you know, you could pretend it was a Harley Davidson while you're pedalling along. So this is what I find fascinating is that... So here's a time where, I guess with these like workers' playtime, like these BBC radio shows, they're slipping in what you've described there, like whether it's Highwaymen or... Peter Paul and Mary, folk music in amongst probably very schmaltzy, boring, anodyne pop music and music of the day. This is post Skiffle. So what was Skiffle like? Because you're talking about some folk influences. You mentioned Dylan. So was Skiffle as a kind of, you know, a sort of take on folk music?
That really sort of
that something.
I, I got on the tail end of the skiffle, but not, it was, I was aware of it, but not quite, you know.
Yeah, you're sort of too old for it almost, but it's like, it's just, I'm just trying to place really the culture of the time.
Yeah, but a lot of people in my age group had older brothers or sisters.
Yeah, so they'd have records. Was,
you know, and I used to go around to my mate's house and his sister, who, she was lovely anyway, I won't say any more than that, but his sister was older. So I used to go around there to see my mate, but stare at his sister. And we'd play all their records while she was out, you know, and she'd have all these sort of things. And then I just sort of started, having got a record player, just carried on buying those records. But then the Beatles then made me look for more because they were listening to Tamla Motown and
yes,
you know, things like that.
Well, this is what I'm interested in. So let's zoom through the 60s. So you're getting 12, 13, 14, you've got your record player. You've got the Beatles. You're going into, presumably, there's records, presumably at the time in Grimsby or Cleethorpes, there was multiple record shops and you could, and Woolworths and places, and you could, on a weekly basis, probably tap into the new, very new and exciting music coming out.
Yeah. Is that the case? And my auntie actually worked in a record shop and I'd go in there and she'd play them. If I wanted to hear them, she'd play them for me, which was quite good.
So did you discover anything in that record shop, your auntie playing you these records? Is there anything that she played one day and you just, you know, it just sent you kind of crazy? Was there anything there that kind of hooked you at the time and maybe you stole that?
No, but for my 13th birthday, I did look at records on the London label, mm-hmm. and I bought two, and I bought Coming Home Baby by Mel Torme and mm-hmm. Zippity-Doo by Bobby Socks and the Blue Jeans, which of course was Phil Spector.
Yeah.
Before the Spector sounded, you know, before Da Doo Ron Ron and all that, there was that. And I was intrigued by the fact that on the other side of Zippity Doo Dah, which has got a great guitar, fuzz guitar solo in it.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
There was an instrumental.
Yeah.
You know, they put, and they just did filled instrumentals on the other side of these records and that. But the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, they would quote other people. And I learned, the first instrument I learned to play was the harmonica, played along with Little Child, John Lennon, on the second album. And then I learned Not Fade Away and realised there were two harmonicas that Brian Jones played. As it changed key, he swapped harmonica and that, and I thought, ugh. And then I realised about keys and things like that. And then as they sort of progressed and got to know Dylan, I was then singing in a band as the sort of second vocalist, and we were doing Yardbirds covers and, you know, all that, For Your Love and all that sort of stuff. And then all of a sudden I discovered Dylan. The Beatles and Dylan and the folk rock or the folk thing started to come through, and the protest movement, for want of a better expression. And I thought, I want some of that. I've been writing songs anyway, because I wanted to be Cleethorpes' Bob Dylan. And I bought an acoustic. I borrowed it. It was only because we went to somebody's house and his dad had two things. One, he had an old guitar. It was a Rossetti Lucky 7. And it was the horrible turquoise sunburst thing, black and turquoise. And that was on the, and it had three strings on it, tape wound strings. But he also had a record collection, his dad, and his dad was at work. And he'd got Ray Charles live at Newport.
Wow.
And I heard that and I thought, whoa. And I can remember laying on the floor because we're all messing about, and Coverlon were having a fag and drinking his dad's booze and all that. But I can remember laying on the floor with this guitar flat.
For our American listeners, they were having a cigarette, just so we're.
We're
all on the same page.
Well, it was a grammar school. You never know.
Well, you never know. It sounds like what a great host. But you're having a cigarette, listening to Ray Charles.
Yeah. And I found that I could play. They did Nighttime Is the Right Time.
Right.
I found that I could change the pitch by hitting that string and moving up and down on this. And that was it. I found that I'd got, it was just something that was a magic moment in the, not for music lovers anyway, but for me, I found that that's how it worked.
I find that super interesting because that's the importance of like that. Well, that's a choir and singing from a young age, because you won't have connected them knowing it's this note, but you will have developed your natural pitch, like within yourself. You know what I mean? Or relative pitch, we should say.
what we're seeing here, I think, is to sort of like, as we move along, is you want to be like Cleethorpe's answer to Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
You're interested in this idea of like protest music and music that has some kind of message to it. You're hearing Ray Charles, you're figuring out on a three-string guitar in your mate's living room or whatever. So we kind of, I can see we're now moving towards all these different parts like forming together. So as we go through, and you've played in the band, so as we go through, what happens to sort of pick up as we go towards the early, you know, the late 1960s, and you're getting ready to leave school and all that kind of stuff? What happens then? Have you got a career in mind? Do you want to be a musician? Do you end up going to college? What happens?
I wanted to be a graphic artist.
That's cool, okay.
I was quite good. In fact, half a dozen of us or so used to go, all went to the same grammar school in the same year. And we've kept in touch, and we go out and we have a curry. And one of them went to a school reunion, and my old art master was there. Apparently, right. He's 80-odd, 90 or something. And, and apparently, Bob, this lad, said to him, "Do you remember Dick Appleton or Rich Appleton?" And he said, "Oh, yeah." And he told me this over the table, over the lunch table at the Indian, in the Indian restaurant. And he said, "Oh, I remember him." And I thought, oh, this was, you know, this was good. And he said, "Yeah." It was a big disappointment to me, that lad. And that was relayed across the, you know, across the curry house. And I thought, oh, you know, and he said, yeah, he should have gone on and gone to the academy and done all sorts, but he didn't. But the reason was, I didn't have a father, couldn't get a grant.
Right.
Only that my father should have paid in maintenance, which wasn't forthcoming.
Right.
Should have paid towards a grant or whatever, couldn't get one. So that was that. So, but...
Okay.
But we all went instead, some of us in the group and another lad who was a bit older who could drive a van, we went and lived in London in a van. Not for very long, but it was just in 1966 when I left school. I didn't stay on.
For me, if you ever, you know, you're in, especially into like British blues music, for me, there's a point like 65, 66, 67, where as far as I'm concerned, like in London at that time, you had this thing with the Rolling Stones, Cream, Hendrix turned up in 66. So when you went down then, you guys were living in a van for a bit. What happened? Did you manage to go out to any of the gigs, see any of the scene? Did you?
We ended up in a school playing, but no, we didn't get anything.
No.
But it was just fabulous fun.
So you're back in Cleethorpes and you're 16 and your band, you know, you and your guys are back up there. So what happens next then? You know,
I'd started, one of the lads that wasn't in the band, the drummer's brother was at a college somewhere. It was a hemophiliac, and at that time they went away. So it sounds awful, but they were locked away in this sort of residential college thing. And we went. It was the end of term. We went to pick him up. He played a bit of guitar. I was just learning. It was at the time, what you call it? I think Rubber Soul had come out.
Yeah.
We were singing songs from that.
Uh-huh.
And he and I got on really well, and we ended up forming a duo because there was two of us. It seemed like a good idea. And we did work in men's clubs doing country and western songs. And it was great.
Well, here we go. Right. Boom. This is what I find fascinating about this. So basically, you went like for people, again, for maybe people in America or wherever, the working men's club scene in Britain was every town had 2, 3, 4 of these places. But what was interesting about that world is it meant that actually, if you decided you want to be a professional musician in, say, 1960 or 1970, you could make a fairly decent living if you wanted by just getting in with agents, probably having 2 or 3 different acts, and then they just put you out every week in these places, which are often maybe not the best gigs in the world because of the nature of the audience, but you could work and develop, you know, the skill. So it sounds like
we didn't actually do much of it, though, because we'd do sort of things like Paul Simon songs and all that, which in a working man's club was, they'll be finished in a minute, we'll get bingo on. Yeah. You know, it was that sort of business. You're in between the bingo and the fighting, really.
Yeah.
That's it. There's a blue moon moment in every working men's club at night, I'm sure, where the ale takes over and they either start scrapping or they've got their arms around one another going, "I love you, you're my best mate."
They're amazing places.
They're fabulous.
I'd like to do a podcast just about them and get people involved. Yeah. So we'll move on. But yeah, this is interesting. So you're now suddenly from being like somebody who's quite a novice guitar player, you're suddenly playing in front of people, learning on the job by the sound of it at 16, 17. So as we move forward, what happens there? what else are you doing to support yourself? And where do you go from like 17, 18, 19, 20? What happens in your life?
I had to get a job.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Because there was only me and my mum. I'd come home penniless. There was only me and my mum, and she worked herself to the bone to keep the roof over my head when her family, my sister, was split up and all this. It's all the way it was, the sort of Judgment of Solomon, all this in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And so it's quite a sad life my mum had, really, because she never had my sister at home. But and she was stuck with me, basically, making all these sounds and noises. So I had to get a job, which I did, which didn't pay a lot. But from that moment...
What were you doing?
You won't believe what I was doing.
Try me.
Three guesses.
Go on then, three guesses.
No, just tell us.
I was a hairdresser, a gents hairdresser. The expression, physician heal thyself.
You're kidding. I had no idea you became a gents hairdresser.
I did my apprenticeship and improvement and all that business, and worked in a hairdressing shop where there was four of us. It's quite famous hairdressers in Cleethorpes called Cripps's Barbers, Cripps's Hairdressers. It's still on the go. Cool. And me and the other lad, I had long hair and a big bushy beard, longer than yours, big ginger bushy beard. And we got a lot of the hippie thing and all that. We got a lot of youngsters who wouldn't go near an older barber, but came for, and especially the mod thing and all that, when they had flat tops with long sideboards and long hair at the back, before the mullet, you know, although being from Grimsby, mullets were always in. It's just that some of them you hate. So that was the first thing I did, but it was really poorly paid.
Yeah. Because you were training and you were, presumably you were gigging a bit as well, or just playing in bands or strumming your guitar.
Well, from then, I've only ever had four jobs in my life.
Yeah.
That's all I've ever done. A hairdressing job. Then I went and worked in a cold store because it was three times the money and you got weekends off. I worked in a frozen food factory, ended up in a cold store as a union representative and all that. Which was great fun. Then worked in another cold store. That was closing down, but I got out of there and I went and worked in a chemical plant, became a reactor operator and basic slug in a chemical plant on the Humber Bank. Walked out of that, but with all along that, within that parallel, however you want to look at it, I never ever worked for a living. All I did was work to get money for instruments and to buy food while I rehearsed, and I always viewed it that I was a musician who was being paid to practice by the people that I allegedly worked for. That's the way, that was my mindset.
I can really like resonate with that. So you that's, you know, I did do all kinds of jobs. So it's, the idea is that you've probably got your heart and your mindset on making music happen somehow down the line. It's just a case of figuring, while you're figuring it out, just supporting yourself. So we're going from 66, 67, 68, 69, 70, 71.
Well,
so
what's happening at this point? In 67, I met Pat.
So you met Pat, who you're still married to, and you've got your two daughters. You told me once about going, what was that club in Cleethorpes?
The South Bank Jazz Club, you mean? Or
you said you saw Rory Gallagher and Duster Bennett and all those people.
The South Bank Jazz Club, which originally was a jazz club that got sort of, you know, evolution took over, and in the end became South Bank Blues, Rock Blues Club sort of thing. And anybody who was anybody played there. And there was a resident band, and I got friendly with one of the resident band who was a vocalist. It was a great vocalist called Charlie. And we used to do things together because he was a great blues shouter. We used to do lots of really good stuff. And I played guitar and harmonica on a rack and all that. And I just read in the local paper that next week we've got this three piece coming from Ireland who's supposedly fairly good, you know, an ex show band guitarist. You think, oh, yeah. And that. And they came, and there's about 15 people in the place. It was a wet Sunday night. And they went on stage at 9 and played till about 1 o'clock. They were just absolutely incredible.
And that was the taste.
That was Taste. Yeah.
Yeah, which are an amazing band, like amazing. So this is what I find fascinating again. So like you know, as an example, you've been singing country music in these working men's clubs, you're working these day jobs.
But at the same time, I've not just been doing country music, I've been writing
Dylan-esque
stuff. I've been playing blues. I'm playing in folk clubs. I was always doing about four or five different acts. I was always interested in electronic music.
Yeah. This is what I want to kind of get the sort of feel of, which is that if you're going to the your mate's playing these clubs and he's like often the resident band and then the name band and you're hanging out, you're basically seeing people now that are legends and actually probably being genuinely like having interactions with them. It's got to affect your musical sort of sensibilities and what and give you the idea of what's possible.
Oh yeah.
And it must have been very inspiring. I imagine if you see Rory Gallagher and you're one of 15 in an audience and you probably don't know who he is, but he's a blazing guitar player.
Yeah.
You'd want to go home and play yourself for days.
Yeah.
Because it's like
that's always the thing is, and when I've and as a teacher, you know, I've done all my qualifications, blah 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 blah. But the one thing that really annoys me when you go and see people in concert, and there's loads of people, you know, a Jeff Beck concert at City Hall is a great example. Coming out, one bloke said, "Well, that's it then. I'm going home and putting my guitar in the bin," you know. And that you do the opposite. It just inspires you to go home and play for 2 or 3 hours, you know. But there again, I was in a fortunate position that I could, because my wife was very understanding. I'd play all night sometime, you know.
Really?
I was still holding down a job, and you know, we've got two kids and all that. But I'd just play all night, seriously. And then so got to work, you know.
This is what strikes me whenever we speak, or when I've been to your house to buy guitars, is just how much music is like. It's not even in you. It's like it is your bones, and that's beautiful. So, what happens as you go through? So you mentioned folk clubs. Like I know of you as somebody who's educated in music. I also know of you as somebody who's done. I mean, you once told me a number of gigs you've probably done. How many gigs do you think you've done over your life and career and stuff?
Not as many as you'd think, probably, because I stopped playing for 6 years in front of people because I was too scared.
Right. Okay.
What happened there? What led to that?
I was just frightened of the people that I was playing for. I was just scared.
But you, so were you, because I from what you said so far, were you playing with in a duo? So when did you start doing gigs on your own?
Before then, really. Oh. From 7 years old, standing up in front of people. I've always done loads of stuff with loads of different people, but at the end of it, I've always just been on my own, really. It's difficult, I suppose. I don't know, it's probably because I've never really thought about it, but being an only child, and then my mum took in lodgers to support us to keep the roof overhead, and I resented that. I had a wonderful childhood, musically and humour-wise. My family, all of them, everybody, were always, there were hills, as they were called, because they took a lot of getting over. And they all had this humour about them. This something about them, there was always this hill humour, and that got us through a lot. But at the same time, she would take in lodgers, and you'd be sort of sat there in front of the coal fire, but you had to move out of the way so a couple of lodgers could keep warm, sort of thing. And I resented sort of sharing my house and my mum.
Yeah, well, you can't understand it at the time, really, can you?
Yeah, so sometimes being in a band or whatever, this sounds awful, I suppose. I've never really thought of it like that. But possibly finding some of the songs that I was finding in my head, I didn't particularly want to share with anybody.
That's interesting.
I wanted them to do them on my own. I wanted them to be mine and like maybe my own little kids or whatever, you know. But having said that, playing in a band now, which I do, you know, it's great. It's a three-piece and it's great fun. And we do stuff that I've, you know, blues, old traditional blues songs that I've written. And it's great to get them out there, you know. But I've got a different, as I got older, obviously got a different perception about all that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I've never been any good at anything, but I'm quite good at doing a lot. in the, you know, I played folk clubs like Martin. I played folk clubs. And at one time, there used to be folk blues clubs. But now it's a bit more, you'd think it was a bit more widespread now, you know, but it, there are actually a lot of places still that are folk clubs, you know. But at one time when I was doing it, if you said about somebody playing electric guitar, you were sort of shown the door, you know. Mm. It was like that, because it was a lot of very traditional places, you know, especially Bradford Way and that sort of thing. A lot of very open-minded people who had very closed minds when it came to folk music. They didn't want it, you know, like Dylan going electric was a shock. I embraced it, thought it was great, but so many other people, you know, and that was worldwide. You know,
I think that's true of a few genres, to be fair. You know, there's like in jazz clubs, there'll be things people don't, some jazz clubs won't have a banjo, if you like.
That's right.
Other jazz clubs won't have electric bass, you know.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, I think every genre has its own things, but I do know what you mean. We've played a few folk clubs where, you know, I was like, I'm not sure we're the right band for this.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. But usually, I mean, they're warm to you usually, don't they? And you get, you know, you end up having a good night. Yeah, I remember going to play in a folk club, funnily enough, as well, in Gainsborough, doing this thing. It was a tribute song to Pete Seeger, because I'm a big Pete Seeger fan. And I just sort of off the stands, there's guitars about, because we used it a lot, you know. And I just took the banjo off, and somebody, and then all of them in the club, somebody went, ooh, banjo. And everybody else in the room went, ooh. And it was like, you think, what? You know, but, you know, it was, and it was only part. It was funny, and it was, so, you know, but it was, there was still a little bit of an edge to it. There was a little bit of a undercurrent there of, ooh, banjo, you know.
There are odd places for clubs for that. And I find that different ones, certain ones have certain rules that are demarcated.
Yeah, yeah.
And you play there and it's fine. Then you take your American folk song, you take your Woody, you know, your Woody Guthrie song or whatever,
yeah, yeah,
to the next one. And they're like, no, you shouldn't be doing that here. You should only be singing stuff that's in a British accent. And you go, all right. So does that mean that an African guy has to only sing African songs? Is that how we do things?
Yeah, and then
people go, no, don't be like that. And you're like,
One of my biggest formative moments musically was, this was when I was 19, 20. The students from the college, they ran this folk club, and a couple of them that I knew from school were there, and they said, come along and play. And I played, I can't remember the title of it, but I played a blues piece. And they were, and the applause was such that they were really surprised. It was a sort of a surprise sounding, hey, you can play this bloke, you know. It was that. But, and ended up doing it on a weekly basis. My wife will tell you, it was, I worked till, fortunately, it was only 200 yards over the road, this club. But I'd work in the barber's shop till 7 at night on a Friday. It was always late night. And then I'd have to go over and then play at the folk club. And they got loads of different people on. They were very good, being, you know, a college thing. They got people from all sorts of places. And at that time as well, I was also singing with a girl blues singer called Carol, who was from Birmingham. She sung blues like that with her voice. She was great. So I was doing that, and I'd go and play support or whatever and part of the folk club thing. But I'd be frightened to death. My wife used to scrape me off the toilet to go to play at this thing. She virtually dragged me out half the time. But played with some great people, you know, like old folkies like Mike Absalom and people like that from years ago, and lots of traditional people as well. But one night we did support, I was asked, because we did a lot of blues, and we did support for Joanne Kelly.
Yeah.
And got talking with Joanne Kelly, and I ended up playing the harmonica for her, sat next to her. I just sat, you know, we were all sat around on the floor, and she sort of said, oh, there's a harp player somewhere, come on. And so I went and sat next to her on the floor, and she sat there and played. And that was really the power in her voice and the passion in her voice and that sort of thing. And there was then this whole thing about, she's a small white girl from Surrey, should she be singing like Memphis Minnie, you know? And she came out with the answer that, well, why not? You know, you get loads of English opera singers, shouldn't that just be left to Italian women to sing that sort of stuff then? And the opposite of that was in the 60s, there was four weekends where there was a Joan Baez concert and a Bob Dylan concert that they did for the BBC. And I went to a music shop where there's in Grimsby called Pools at the time, and it was run by the younger, well, the younger lad eventually went into it. But the father of the shop was a real, they tuned pianos and that's what they did. Everything else was peripheral. And I went in there one day and he said, did you see that young girl on television on Saturday night? And I said, oh, he said, that Joan Baez woman. So I said, oh yeah. And he said, it's absolutely criminal. And I thought, I wonder what he's going to say. And he said, it shouldn't be allowed. And I thought, well, it's folk music, you know, it's a bit of protest song, whatever you want to call it. And he said, no, I don't mean that. He said, with a voice like that, she should be singing opera. She shouldn't be wasting a voice like that on, you know, on folk song.
Because she's such a good singer. So you've I mean, it's interesting. You're describing a real sort of interesting time and place here. So what I'm amazed about is like your obvious love of all kinds of music. So at the time, as we're talking now in this late 60s, 70s, like, is there anybody that you aspire to be? Are there any kind of musicians, singers or players that you were like, I'd like to be like, they're my guy or my gal, or I'd like to be like them?
Bob Dylan, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, probably
well,
Dylan.
Yeah, all else of them, you none aspire of them. To? You know, yeah. Like, I mean, I was lucky enough to sort of play a bit once with Bert Jansch. I'm lucky enough to know Anne Briggs fairly well, you know. She sang backing vocals.
Anne Briggs is one of my favourite singers. We talked about somebody selling flowers at a market. Was that Anne Briggs? Or was that
that was Annie, yeah. She used to have a little red van and she lived near Horncastle in Lincolnshire. And she used to do the markets and sell, because she got an encyclopedic knowledge of wild flowers, old flowers.
Yeah.
You know, and
Anne Briggs is, you know. I mean, oh man, this is, I mean, just one of the best, really, of that era, you know, up there with the Bert Jansch's and the Martin Carthers and all that. So let's move forwards now. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you ended up teaching music. Tell us about that. Tell us about getting to become like an educator, as well as, you know, you've gone from these other jobs you've had to like educating. Well,
that by accident. It was just a friend of mine who I'd been at school with and owned a music shop on Cleethorpes High Street. But I went in his shop one day and he'd got these Pro Martin guitars, which were, you know, this Japanese copies of a Martin. And I bought one from him for 110 quid. And I played this tune that I'd written. And he said, who did that? Who wrote that? So I said, well, I did. And he said, oh, I thought it was like Coloured Aristocracy and all that sort of thing that Grossman plays. He said, you know, I didn't know you could do that. So, well, I wrote it. I can't help, you know. So, yeah. So anyway, that was that. And we got really talking about guitars and things. And then one Wednesday, I went in the afternoon. And he said, oh, now then, do you fancy doing something tonight? So I said, well, what, you know? And he said, well, the local adult ed bloke that teaches guitar is off sick. And I've had a call from this school because they used to do, I mean, adult ed at one time was brilliant, you know, evening classes. You could do it in, you know, guitar. You could do what? You know, welding, flower arranging and silent killing. You know, you could do all of that. And they just said, oh, no, the guy's off sick. And the local authority, you know, the council, just rung me up to see if I knew anybody that could step in at short notice. And he said, and Pete would always do something, whether he could do it or not, if there was money, he'd do it. He'd have a go at doing it. So, and he said, so I said, I'd do it. So I said, oh. He said, what am I going to do? So I said, what do you mean you're going to do? He said, I don't know what to do. He said, it's just 2 hours of teaching guitar. So I said, well, go then. He said, well, come with us. So I said, no, there's football on telly. And he said, oh, go on. So I ended up going with him. And we went, and I was amazed because I'd not been back to school. You know, this was 1981.
Right.
And so I'd not been back in school since 1966 when I left. And I went in, and there was just a dozen guys sat there, all desperate to learn to play the guitar. And so you got all these people who wanted to be, not like I'd ever been in a classroom before. Most of us didn't want to be in there then. They all wanted to be in there and learn, you know. And we did it, and we went for a drink afterwards. And he said, "You rotten so-and-so." So I said, "What?" He said, "You lied to me. You've done that before." So I said, "No." And he said, "You have." He said, "You know, couldn't you tell?" He said, "They were just up, Tom. You know, it was great." Because he said, "I got to do virtually nothing. And you thoroughly enjoyed yourself, obviously." He said, "All the blokes did, you know, and that." And he said, "You ought to do that." And so, yeah. So anyway, I said, "You know, when you're sober, we'll talk about it." But I saw him the following week, and the other bloke had got better. And then he said, "Seriously, you want to do it?" So I'll go on then. So I did. I just put an advert in the paper for one night, advertising finger picking ragtime, bottleneck, you know, acoustic playing. I'm not a whittler. I'm not a fret melter. I would never be able to sort of do that sort of stuff. But I just did that, and I got four lessons, £3.60 an hour, Robin Devil. Yeah. And it was great. And that's it. All just started from then. And then I ended up doing the qualifications and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, yeah.
And teaching at, in the end, teaching at two or three different night schools for different authorities. And then also this other thing came up where, which was, by then I was working, still in the chemical plant, but had enough of it. And there was this advert in the paper saying, are you a failed musician? No, it wasn't that as such, but I thought, that's me. You know, I've been headhunted at last. You know, have you ever played for years but never thought you could make money out of it? Blah, blah, blah. And it was Access to Music, the right. company Access to Music, founded and run by John Ridgeon, trumpet player, you know, and a great bloke. Got on very, very well with him. And it was what they call an IMF course. You went as a musical instrument facilitator. You were basically, you got put in a school placement and you learned how to teach. But it was done differently to ordinary education. And John had this theory of spiral learning. You know, you keep revisiting. And the one thing that John Ridgeon did say that's always stuck with me is, if you're teaching somebody something or trying to show somebody something and they don't get it, it might not be them. Yeah. It might be you that's not doing it from the right angle.
Yeah.
And I've always sort of thought that works. You know, and I've dealt with having an autistic daughter personally as well.
Yeah.
You know, you do things from a different way and it can work. And you can sneak the music in insidiously. You know, should have been a politician really, but anyway. From there, I ended up a senior tutor on a course in rock music for 16 to 24 year olds. And I did that for 7 years, and it was great fun. Basically, it was just there was about half a dozen of us tutors that it was just a drinking contest for a week with students attached. And it was great. But I used to do alternative tuning workshops. And because I got into alternative tuning really early on, I discovered the drop D tuning on Bob Dylan's first LP when I was like 15. And I just went from there. You know, I realized that when you did In My Time of Dying, it was in open D, you know, and all that sort of stuff, or partial D. But I really ploughed my own furrow in that respect.
And can I go back a minute, Dick? So, you know, you did some before you, what was this school of teaching you joined, so that you were doing IMF? What was it called?
Yeah, it was Instrumental Music Facilitator. That was it. Well, the company was called Access to Music.
Yeah, that's
they,
it.
Courses all over the country.
Yeah, I think I heard that. And just before you did that, you said you did your qualifications. What were you? Is this music qualification?
Yeah. Well, teaching qualifications.
Oh, PGCE.
Yeah, I did the PGCE, right. City and Guilds, all that sort of stuff. Found it all as dry as dust.
I find it super interesting because my background is like quite mixed in that. And that there's a school education does a very classical form of music, and like a lot of people, they're not interested, and it's not cool to be into Beethoven, so you don't pay any attention. And as I said, there's like the way that music is taught in school is that it's underfunded, and it's not, you're not given the opportunities to try teaching it in several different ways, so it's harder to engage them. So those kind of access to music courses, and where you said those weekends of doing those workshops, I think they're I think sometimes they're given a bit of less of a status, as they're like a kind of less important form of music education. Yeah. But I think they're just as important, just as valid, in a completely different way. You can really influence people, especially there was like a good one near me in Wales for like a young teenagers. It's like a youth group essentially, but it was like a music based youth group, and that was amazing. You know, as well as the, thankfully, I had good county stuff that we're doing.
Yeah, they are actually more important, I think, these than the actual classical type lessons in schools, because there's a greater catchment. There are more people disenfranchised from music because of the way they look or the way they act, and you know, than there are that do the, you know, that can afford a peripatetic teacher coming in and afford the lessons where they sit there, six of them for half an hour, being taught four notes badly, you know, or wrongly a lot of the time.
Yeah, I was agreeing with you. I was saying they're very important and very useful. You know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So I think, you know, yeah, I did, when I did the IMF course, which was prior to becoming the senior tutor and teacher of whatever, you know, and all that, there was a school placement and you were there 3 days a week. Going in there, and that really did make me mind up that I don't want to teach or try teaching in environments where people don't want to be there.
Mm.
But the amount of people, you know, like the music teacher, there were two, both sort of just postgraduates or whatever, working in there. And the amount of kids that haul out and make them stand against the wall. And I'd be, you know, told to make sure they stand against the wall and don't turn around. And when the teacher had gone, the first thing I would do was say, right, turn around, what's up, mate, and talk. And one of them played piano and the trumpet. And when I asked these teachers afterwards, did you know he's done concerts at the town hall? They got no idea. And that resonated with me, because when I left Clear Grammar School, as it was, I could play five different instruments. I'd been writing songs since I was 7 years old. And nobody in the music department knew at all. You know, and it's just, and that's still, it's like it now. You know, and the way that music, the whole thing with, you know, now with the way the arts has just been left, you know, in the whole pandemic situation, this whole thing now with, you know, Elton John is sort of having a big argument with, can't remember the official's name, but he was supposed to be sorting it out. The whole touring musicians especially, have just been hung out to dry by certain parties, but we won't get.
It has been recently, but the interesting thing about the education, just on the subject of musical education, one of the most interesting and, in a way, saddest things I ever heard happened in your town of Cleethorpes. I played at Cleethorpes Jazz Festival a number of years ago with an ex of mine in the, is it the church or the cathedral? I can't remember now, but there's a big, beautiful...
Minster. Well, they call it a minster, but it is. It's a church.
But afterwards, we did the set, and then we went to go and play. They said, can you come and play a set in school? We'll just bump your feet up a little bit. So we went to play in the school, and all the kids respond amazingly to music, as well, you know. And it was and they were really interesting instruments, and it was beautiful. And at the end, when all the kids had gone, we were talking to the teachers, and the teachers were saying, so this is probably down the road from your house, to be honest, in the rougher part of town. But the teachers were saying, like, we've tried to get the kids learning instruments. They're all, at that age, really good at it. Said what we did was we did a fundraiser. Basically, the teachers whipped around, bought ukuleles for all the kids, $12.99 ukuleles or whatever. They said, and then the second week, the kids came back. Half of them didn't have the ukuleles. Third week, maybe 25% of the kids had the ukuleles, and the parents were just selling them.
Yeah.
This is where like funding is so important, because those kids, if the parents can't sort it out, then those kids will never get the opportunity. When you think about those people's lives and the opportunities that are missed, for the sake of a $12.99 ukulele that could be kept at school,
yeah,
let's now just talk a little bit about your kind of playing styles. You mentioned all these different tunings. I've heard you play. I've got some of your CDs in the house, and I think, you know, you've got one which was all like, I'd say virtuosic, amazing instrument, like folk instrumentals, blues instrumentals, like guitar artistry kind of stuff. So, you know, you could really haul ass on the guitar. So as you go through the 80s and 90s, what kind of stuff was influencing you? And at what point did you become a crazy guitar kind of collector? Because you've got a lot of nice stuff. We're talking, you know, lots of lovely old 30s Gibsons, 30s Nationals, nice things.
Yeah. I'm very, very lucky. I am very lucky. I've got a very understanding wife.
Yeah.
Who doesn't know half. There is that thing in the, oh God, when I die, please don't let my wife sell my instruments for what I told her I paid for them. I do know that my learning curve was quite steep. I don't ever remember getting to any point because I still don't think I'm there. You know, you're always searching. The one thing I do is look for stuff. And I'm writing a lot of stuff, you know, lyrically as well as musically. But there's lots and lots of stuff that's still to come out, and I'm still looking for stuff. That's why tunings help a lot. You know, I mean, I've used, I don't know how many tunings. I was lucky enough to meet Buffy St. Marie and talk to her about tunings.
Oh, that's interesting. I did a gig with her in Rotherham, of all places.
Oh, she's a fabulous person.
And do you know what? I knew the name. I was like, oh, Buffy St. Marie, yeah, I've seen her on YouTube and played a gig. She was amazing.
Yeah.
And then I went home and, like, there's bloody film of her singing with Leonard Cohen and stuff. And I was like, oh, I've missed an opportunity here to sort of, like, hang out with her more, you know. Yeah. But
I was lucky enough to talk to her for about an hour.
Oh, you lucky bastard.
Played at Cambridge. Folk festival she was on, and I was lucky enough to talk to her, and I just said to her, I said, can I just say thank you? I read an article on you in the Melody Maker written by Carl Dallas, the folk writer, and he said this woman's coming over doing a tour and she plays in 19 different tunings. And I always remember thinking, I'm going to learn more than that, and I did, and I do. And I told her that, and I said, and now I make a living, or I have, you know, doing alternative tunings workshops. And they're great, you know, they're really good fun to do. And I said, you know, and it's thanks to you that, and it's the discovering of it. And she said, yeah, you just twiddle a few things, see what comes out, right? And I said, yeah, exactly that. And then there was an interview with Joni Mitchell, and she said one day, I just sat there on the edge of the ocean and I tuned my guitar to the sound of the waves on the rocks and the birds. And then you listen to the tuning that she comes out with and you think, yeah, you're spot on there, missus.
This brings us to something to sort of finish up here. Like that, what you're talking about there is a very kind of, for a lot of people, a very interesting and unique way of playing and thinking about the guitar. So I'd like to talk about like the bands that you're now involved in and your music. So when we're talking about alternative tunings and things, do you think you've got to a point where you kind of see the guitar beyond the guitar's capabilities? You see it as more like a noise generating instrument. Do you feel like you've managed to make the guitar or use the guitar in a way which is beyond what most people think of it? And is that something that's of interest to you?
I don't know. I know one person once introduced me saying, you won't believe the sounds that you're going to hear are coming out of a guitar. But that was done when I was, because I still do often, there's things on YouTube that you can see, maybe I use a Roland guitar synth with it.
Mm-hmm.
So you can play ragtime guitar that comes out as ragtime jangly piano and things like that, which is great for. But at the same time, it's not purposely trying to make it sound unmusical, if you know what I mean. Because there's still, no. I come back to this harmony thing, you know, yeah. And there's always notes that will enrich another note, if you know what I mean.
That's the beauty of using different tunings, isn't it? Is that you develop different kind of voicings that,
yeah,
you probably wouldn't ever think of in a normal tuning. Let's now, you mentioned about playing on stage. What I find interesting about you is you have made a living playing music and teaching music, you know, for a large part of your life.
Yeah.
But I get confused with your acts and your stage names and things. So if we ignore the fact we're in the middle of this terrible coronavirus pandemic at the moment, let's just pretend that never happened. What acts have you been doing over the last few years of playing, and where can people find your music now? To sort of, can people hear this music or buy the CDs?
Well, yeah, one thing that I did do a lot of was a thing called, which was a play on the Frippertronics that Robert Fripp did, him being one of my favourite guitar players. I did a thing called Dickatronics, and that was using two volume pedals, two pedal boards and a guitar synth and a rack system, and fading it all in and out and doing it with finger style. So, you know, you play one note and you get eight back sort of thing, yeah. And all that. Pretty much developing that at the same time as John Martin was doing what he was doing.
Yeah.
But never really copying him or anything like that. It was going in, it was the same sort of thing, but going in a different direction. But I was doing quite a bit of that. But before the world stopped, really four different acts, say Jack of all trades, master and all, the basically the singer-songwritery folk club act.
And what name do you go out as under that?
Dick Appleton.
So that's your. That, this is what I want to. Even I want to know this because we talk so much. So Dick Appleton is you.
You can see Dick Appleton on YouTube. You know.
Yeah.
So
Dick Appleton, you're doing folk stuff. You're doing your own stuff and traditionals.
No, mainly my own songs. Yeah. That I got the government.
Yeah.
Topical songs.
So that goes back to that desire you said earlier about wanting to be Dylan when you were younger. So you sort of that Dylan of that era, sort of singing against power, basically.
Yeah, not on purpose as such. No. Not on purpose, you know, just singing about what was there.
Yeah, so that's Dick Appleton. What's the other? Because Soft Shoe Sam is how I first found you about probably before me and Jack started playing the Washboard Resonators. I found some of your Soft Shoe Sam videos. I think you were playing One Kind Favour or something on YouTube. Yeah. And it was, I watched every video on YouTube that Resonator guitars on, and I found yours. And then when I was put in touch with you about you might have some guitars for sale, that's when I was like, oh, I know this guy. It sort of all came together. So Soft Shoe Sam.
Well, that came really. I mean, there's another thing that going on from the folk thing. I do an act with a guy called Paul Bellamy, and we go out as the Bell Apple Boys, and we do a lot because his name's Bellamy and my name's Appleton. Obviously, it's a good job that my name's not Enderby, or we would have been in trouble. And we do lots of really. He's a stunning fiddle player. But don't tell him I said so. And we do a lot of daft stuff and a lot good of very difficult stuff, you know. And it's good fun. We have a real good laugh. So there's that. But there's also the Dan Busters stuff that I wrote for the BBC commissioned me to write. And I wrote 40-odd songs for the Dan Busters thing. And we're taking that out on the road again.
Hang on a second. What's that? I don't know about that.
In 2013, it was the 70th anniversary of the Dan Busters raid. And the BBC Radio Lincolnshire, being Bomber County, put on a timeline programme from 9 at night till 6 in the morning. And I was commissioned to write songs for it. Yeah. And I wrote 42 songs in a 3-month period. And they used 8 of them. But anyway, we're taking it out on the road now after all this time. Got a 20-foot screen, projector. I've been working on the graphics for 7 months. Got it all done because there's 500-odd photographs go past, over 20 songs, and they're all relevant to the thing. And I've been working on it for about 7 months. We've been rehearsing it like mad for 5 months. We've just got it to the point. You know when you're rehearsing and all of a sudden you look at one another, don't you think, yeah, that just worked. Now let's start cooking. This is good. And we got to that point, and that was a fortnight before the lockdown.
Was this like guitar-based music? Because when I think Dan Busters, just think of Dan Busters March, obviously a classical piece.
No, it's all my songs. There's some on YouTube, check them out. It's basically guitar and fiddle oriented, and banjo. There's a banjo thing on there. But there's one song I do called Commoners and Kings, and that's written from the point of view of Bounds Wallace's conscience. You know, because 53 guys died, and he had that on his conscience. Mm. For the rest of his life, you know, and the whole thing about the blanket bombing and all that. So it's, you know, the whole thing, it's a tribute to the Dan Busters, but it's done, you know, there's some humour in it. It's very serious, but you can always find humour in everything, you know, with a face like mine, you have to, you know. But yeah,
that sounds like a great production anyway.
Yes. But there are bits of it on YouTube knocking about. The Soft Shoe Sam thing came from doing some blues I just thought I'm going to do a blues album because I'm, you know, I've got my own little studio and I record everything in it. And I've got all these national guitars. So I did a track for each guitar, basically. So I did, at the time, I did 16 different tracks using 16 different nationals, which was a bit pompous, wasn't it?
I think that's about the coolest thing I've ever heard in the world.
Yeah. But I did that. And then I thought, right, if I put Dick Appleton's name on that, people say it's that boring, bald-headed old git that moans about the government all the time, you know.
Or so you've got this blues alter ego, Soft Shoe Sam.
Yeah, so I did that. Because you can go away as Soft Shoe Sam and play in Bradford, in Leeds, in wherever, and nobody knows who you are. But if I go out as Dick Appleton, people will have this, oh, it's him. I've looked him up on YouTube and, and so yeah, Soft Shoe Sam's a different entity, and he's almost like he is an alter ego, and I talk about him in the sort of in the third party sort of thing.
Well, I think it's a good thing if you're then going down the blues route, that's like you can just do that
I can hide behind that as well, singing wise. I can do that where I wouldn't do it as a folky,
That's fascinating. So what else is the electric band as well?
Yeah, there's the South Bank Blues Collective, and we're a three-piece.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any other acts that people can look up and check out?
There are some YouTube things, I think, if you search about. There are some YouTube and Facebook things of the South Bank Blues Collective.
As we're going to tie this up now, are there any other kind of acts that you do that we can share with people, or have we covered the main ones now?
Like I'm booked to do a Village Hall, Dick Appleton, Dicko's Christmas Extravaganza. I write a lot of daft poetry, not a lot of daft poetry.
Hopefully you're doing that around Christmas, not just, it's June now. Not like
I know, but you've got to look forward to things. But there's things, like I told my tortoise about Christmas. It was a big mistake. Since the beginning of September, he's been trying to stay away. He's as mad as his backside. He's lost all sense of form because he's found out he's been alive for 60 Christmases and he's slept through every one. And he goes on, there's all this, and he goes on for ages about him wanting presents and all that.
That's great.
This is what I really admire about you, which is this the creativity, the wellspring is endless and unfiltered with you. And I know personally, just because I've been to your house, to collect a guitar in the garden, and I got. Here's two CDs I just made in the last few months. Take them away. One was like an electro one, and then with keyboard. And the other one was like the guitar, fancy guitar stuff. You are always creating and making stuff. So with all this lockdown we've been having with coronavirus and stuff, is that something you found has helped like get through it? Just being in your recording studio, going in the bunker, and just making art constantly and stuff.
You see, I've got a big problem with art because I cannot switch off.
No, clearly.
Ever in my sleep. I can remember every dream virtually I have.
Wow.
And I wake up two or three times in the night. I want to and I can't. I cannot switch off. Even when I had a stroke 5 years ago now, and even when I had the stroke, I was still creating things in my head and...
I did not know that.
And all that sort of thing, so...
Any other names we've not mentioned? Anybody that you've really enjoyed spending time or seeing?
No, I've been very lucky. I've met loads and loads of good people. Loads and loads of people I really admire who are no longer with us.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a chance to play with some of them. But, that's the trouble. As you get older, you find yourself talking more about people. And they say, of course, he's no longer with us. And you think, oh.
It's a sad fact of life, isn't it? But it's something we all have to deal with, I guess, at our own time. But what it also sounds like is that music, has been this great companion, and it's really been sort of the driving force in your life by the sound of it in so many ways, whether it's...
It's only when people point that out. I've never really thought about it.
But that's because it's just always been there, I guess. It's just normal. But, even from an outsider's point of view and somebody who also is heavily in music, it's just what I get from listening to you and talking to you in normal times when we're not filming it. It's all about music and it's all there. And what a beautiful gift to give and share and teach, but also receive and be in the world with. So I think we'll bring it to an end there, unless anybody's got anything else to say. We've got some standard questions that we ask everybody.
Okay, so knowing what you know now, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Don't be such a prat and listen more.
Another question which we ask people, very serious question, is how do you like your tea?
Tea? I don't drink tea. It's the
day. There we go again. Isn't that fascinating? It says so much about
it. It's awful. I can remember the day I drank my last cup of tea ever.
When was that?
I was 7 years old. And wow. It was made at my auntie's house one Sunday tea time, listening to a budgie called Mickey talking, because it was a wonderful talker. And somebody poured me a cup of tea, and it was awful. It was disgusting. And that's the last time I've drunk a cup of tea.
And finally then, Dick, so who would play you in a film of your life?
Oh, good God. John Hurt, because I knew John Hurt. He was my cub master for a while. He was my cub master. His father was the Reverend Hurt, who was our Sunday school teacher at St. Aidan's Church in Cleethorpes. And John, his son, was an art student at Grimsby Art College. And we used to talk about art a bit, but I was only in the Cubs. And he was our arcaler for, I think, 3 weeks while his dad was ill. And we got on really well. He was great.
Yeah, okay, great. And that's the guy that would play you in your film of your life. I think we've covered it. We've covered it all. We've heard so much there. And, you know, that's fascinating. Just that
entertain, by the way, is the word.
What?
That's what I would do. Entertain them.
Yeah, that's, do you know what? That's bang on, is that I think that's really true. If you are performing, it should be for the audience, and you're there as like a conduit for that. And that's a good thing, you know.
Yeah.
However that entertainment is presented, but to entertain people.
Yeah, I don't think people should go away from a gig feeling better than when they went to it.
I couldn't agree more, and I think it's a great chance for escapism. I think people really want that. I think people won't take it for granted like they used to do, like that chance to leave the house and go to a magical place for a couple of hours.
Yeah, hopefully people will be as desperate to go to gigs as the artists are to perform them.
So there we go then. That was Dick Appleton. You know, there's a man who's had, you know, a life in music and an interest in life in music. You don't know Dick at all, do you, Jack? So what kind of stood out to you there?
First time I'd met him. Yeah, actually, for me, it was a bit, I felt that he's obviously very musical and very creative, and to come up with poems and that sort of music, and to have followed education through like that and want to kind of pass it on to other people. But probably he touched on it a bit and didn't go into a lot of details, but a bit of a difficult home life perhaps, and not a lot of money.
Well, I think the thing he said about the graphic design was the thing, like the art teacher. But then what it sounds like is that he had this passion of music, and so he it wasn't going to be being a graphic artist. So what happened was he just eventually made music his life, and he was working his jobs. And
music's his passion, isn't it? You know, definitely.
Yeah, and it's that weird thing that, you know, I think something you and I probably both have met people where, is it sad that maybe they didn't go down the route they wanted to do, or was that actually like a blessing in disguise where it then left the door open to have a life in music? Because you're like, well, what else? I've got nothing else to lose. Whatever it is, it isn't, like we say, it isn't about the money with him. It's just that he's got all the guitars that all his heroes played. He's got an example of everything, and it's just a way of life, you know. And I think that's what comes across to me whenever I speak to him. This is the longest outro ever, Jack, but it was very interesting and lovely to talk to these people and just see what makes them tick, really. He's a great example of it.
Exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what we'll do, we'll say goodbye for now.
See you next time. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to the Washboard Resonators Present.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate, and leave a comment.
And to support our band, please sign up to the mailing list. You'll find the link in the show notes and on the website.